From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Hospitals are seeing organ donations increase as a direct result of the ongoing opioid epidemic. Now, donations from overdose victims can mean the difference between life and death for people in dire need of transplants. We're going to hear about some of the consequences of what this means for organ recipients from the experts in just a moment. On a happier note, we're going to look at what marriage may do to couples' personalities. But just ahead this hour, on Monday, we talked about the growing number of women running for local office in Georgia. We had Sarah Riggs Amico on the show. She's a Democratic candidate in Georgia running for lieutenant governor.
Women do have an incredible capacity for empathy, and I think right now empathy is something we could see a lot more of in our government.
Here are your first thoughts. T. Harris tweets, "Well overdue, because I find it absolutely appalling that we have a man in office that's okay with grabbing women by the hoo-ha. We as men consider ourselves kings, so that means women should be considered queens," so says T. Harris on Twitter. I can't believe I just had to say hoo-ha on the radio. Always want to know what you think, listeners. How do you feel about the record number of women running for office in Georgia? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. On yesterday's show, we talked about the continuing opioid crisis, but the Drug Enforcement Administration, or agency rather, says that methamphetamine, crystal meth, is the number one drug threat to Atlanta. This after investigators found 500 pounds of meth stored in Disney figurines in Atlanta. The drugs seized last month are valued at nearly $2 million. Vernon Keenan is the director of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. He joins us to talk about meth in Georgia this morning. Good morning, Vernon.
Good morning.
Also with us is Jim Langford. He's executive director of the Georgia Prevention Project, an organization aimed at stopping teens from doing drugs. It evolved from something called the Georgia Meth Project. And Jim, let me start with you. Just remind everybody, what exactly is meth?
Well, meth is a chemical. It's not really a natural substance at all. It was derived from a variety of other chemicals. The origination of it was actually in World War II, and Hitler's chemists came up with a way to have troops fight for several days with no sleep and kill without remorse. So it's a terrible chemical that's been around for quite a while.
What does it look like? How do you consume it? What does it do to you?
Well, it comes in various forms. The crystal form that you're talking about, you know, is one where these crystals have formed in the bottom of a tank or a bottle where the people have created this substance. They're then able to crush it up, and they can snort it, they can smoke it, they can inject it, they can get it into the body a variety of ways, even in a soft drink. So there are a variety of reasons that it's easy to consume, and why people go after it. It affects the body by revving the body up. It creates a high five times more powerful than cocaine, and that high can last for quite a while, 6 to 12 hours.
And what are the particular hazards associated with it?
Well, it wears out every organ in the body. You know, my organization morphed into the Georgia Prevention Project to go after the opioid and heroin problem. And so we make a comment, not lightly, that opioids and heroin will kill you quickly. Meth will kill you slowly. Meth will destroy every organ in the body eventually because all those organs just wear out. And there's only about a 5% chance that once you're on meth that you're ever going to get off and stay off.
Meanwhile, as you mentioned, opioids are killing people by the thousands. Vernon Keenan with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, do you buy the DEA's argument that meth is the biggest drug threat to the metro Atlanta area and not opioids?
Yeah, well, they're both major problems for the Atlanta area, but methamphetamine is a tremendous problem, and I think the DEA is looking at the number of seizures of drugs in the state, and they're basing their calculation on that plus the destructive nature of methamphetamine. Now, we've seen a marked increase in methamphetamine seizures in Georgia since 2002. The Georgia Bureau of Investigation operates the crime lab system for the state. We're the only crime lab in the state of Georgia. Mm-hmm. So we're able to track trends of drugs very closely based on seizures by law enforcement. And we've seen that methamphetamine has now become the number one seized drug in the state of Georgia. In fact, it encompasses 40% of all the drugs submitted to the state crime laboratory. So, you know, what is associated with methamphetamine besides the widespread use and seizure is the violence that's associated with persons who use methamphetamine, because a meth user is very prone to being sexually active with children. They're very destructive. They're very violent. They confront police. And many of the instances you see in the state of Georgia of very violent crimes are related to persons who are using methamphetamine.
And the DEA is calling Atlanta an East Coast hub for meth, Vernon. Why do you think that is?
Because of our transportation system. What has occurred is originally methamphetamine was being manufactured in small laboratories throughout the state of Georgia. And a decade ago, we seized over 800 methamphetamine laboratories. This past year, we seized only 16. It doesn't mean that meth has decreased. What has occurred is that the Mexican drug cartels have stepped in, and they now supply a very pure form of methamphetamine, and the users do not have to manufacture this themselves in small laboratories. In fact, the cost of methamphetamine has dropped 80% in the past 10 years. So it's very pure, it's very cheap, and it's widely distributed. But the transportation system is what brings methamphetamine into the Atlanta area, and then it's distributed throughout the southeast. So we're the hub for the Mexican drug cartels, not only for methamphetamine, but for fentanyl and other types of drugs.
Now, assuming you wanted to approach this problem from a law enforcement perspective, which is your business, Vernon, that is trying to address it through prohibition, what could this area of the country possibly do to prevent itself from those factors that you protect itself from those factors that you mentioned? The interstates are going to go to Atlanta no matter what you do. What can you do?
Well, the key to this is prevention efforts to stop people from ever experimenting with methamphetamine, particularly children, because it can be almost an instantaneous addiction. So we strongly support education efforts to educate the public about the dangers of methamphetamine, and then we do aggressive law enforcement. You know, one of my assessments is that the large amount of methamphetamine seized in Georgia and then submitted to our crime laboratory is based upon acts of violence where the law enforcement investigating those acts of violence, sexual assault, et cetera, they find methamphetamine. And so this is part of the story here. But, you know, opioid addiction and what we're experiencing in the United States is terrible also. But that problem has overshadowed what is happening in the methamphetamine world.
We're talking about the impact of meth, particularly on the metro Atlanta area. The DEA saying that meth is the number one drug threat to Atlanta, surpassing opioids. And we're talking about this with Vernon Keenan, whom you just heard there. He's the director of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. Also with us is Jim Langford. He's with the organization, the Georgia Prevention Project, which works with teens to try to prevent them from doing the stuff in the first place. And Jim, when it comes to meth, what's the most persuasive argument that you've got when talking to young people to tell them to stay away from this stuff?
Well, we launched a major campaign in 2010 and 11 that Vernon helped us get off the ground, brought to Georgia by a fellow named Tom Siebel, who in Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming, he'd spent about $30 million of his own money to try to create this campaign. And the campaign was very simple, very direct. And that is to make meth uncool among teenagers, both from ages 12 to 17. Make it uncool, make meth lifestyle undesirable. And we launched that campaign in 2010. We launched 26,000 TV radio spots, 23,000 TV spots, and 588 billboards with a heavy, heavy saturation over about a 14-month period. And we have seen those statistics show that those younger people really do stay away from meth. So a lot of the meth that you're seeing now are in the age groups, you know, 25 and older. The younger kids still believe, even as a result of that campaign, even though it was several years ago, still believe that meth is not something they want anything to do with. They don't know
how specifically do you convince them that it's uncool? Do you Do you appeal to the overdeveloped sense of vanity that a lot of young kids
Absolutely.
Have? I mean, meth, there's certainly a stereotype that after a few years on meth, people really look like hell.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of them. Absolutely. And you know, show them what they're physically going to look like. Show them that this is not a glamorous lifestyle, that you're going to be obsessed with this meth. You're going to be hanging around with a terrible crowd, and only bad things are going to result. Now, it's not a preachy campaign at all. And a good part of what we do as well is have younger people actually trained to train other people, sort of peer-to-peer counseling, if you will, or peer-to-peer education with these younger people influencing each other. And so we've now also trained about 750 teachers in Georgia through an online system so that we can then track those teachers, see what they're teaching, see how they're teaching in the classroom, and actually help kids train those kids to actually help the teachers teach that class in the classroom. So we've seen a lot of good results come out of that. We've seen a lot of, I could run some statistics for you to tell you what those attitudes, how they've changed. But we feel very good about where we're going with methamphetamine. Again,
so we've talked. Go ahead, Vernon.
Go ahead.
Well, we've talked about approaching this from a law enforcement right. perspective with you, Vernon, the GBI. Mm-hmm. We've talked about approaching it from a prevention perspective with you, Jim. What about approaching it from a treatment perspective? Are there particular challenges to treating addicts, who are people who are addicted to methamphetamine as opposed to other drugs? Either of you.
Well, meth is just really difficult. I mean, there aren't any really good substitutes, if you will, you know, drugs that help get them off of methamphetamine, wean them off. It just doesn't. Huh. They're not any good magic bullets for that.
What does withdrawal feel like?
Well, withdrawal on meth comes fairly quickly, meaning that what happens, meth actually gets out of the system within 48 hours, 72 hours. It comes out of the system very quickly. These people who are on meth, they may stay awake for 5 or 6 or 7 days. I mean, they just, or even longer, and then they'll crash for 2 or 3 days. And so the withdrawal comes from the dopamine in the brain that has been revved up so high, and then, you know, they've got to come down off of that. But it's very, very difficult to treat. People want to go back to that dopamine high, and they keep coming back to that. So it's not the same as a physical addiction in terms of the organs shutting down and doing those things that happen with an opioid. It's a little more insidious than that.
Vernon, last word goes to you. What's the GBI going to do about this problem next?
Well, we're continuing partnering with our federal law enforcement agencies to combat the drug cartels bringing in the large amounts of methamphetamine and being distributed out. We aggressively work with federal partners. We make major seizures. I mean, this is money. This is a business for the drug cartels. Yeah. They're bringing in drugs to meet a demand, and we're trying to dry that supply up.
That was GBI Director Vernon Keenan. We were also talking there with Jim Langford, Director of the Georgia Prevention Project, talking about methamphetamines, which, believe it or not, the DEA says is the number one drug threat to the metro Atlanta area nowadays, not the opioid epidemic, though both obviously very, very significant problems. Thanks to you both, and good luck with your work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. A new study from Johns Hopkins University says that 1 in 8 organ transplants in the U.S. now comes from a person who died of a drug overdose. In 2000, that was just 1 in 100. This shift comes as the opioid crisis continues to ravage Georgia and indeed the rest of the nation. As we continue to address this public health crisis, are there consequences for organ donation that people should be concerned about? Dr. Christine Duran joins us. She is Assistant Professor of Medicine and Oncology at Johns Hopkins University. She's one of the co-authors of this study. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us is Dr. Don Pearson. He's Executive Director of the Emory Transplant Center, where he's seen a lot of this up front, close and personal, no doubt. We'll talk to him about that. Good morning, Dr. Pearson.
Good morning.
Dr. Duran, what got you interested in studying this?
Well, most Americans know that we're facing an epidemic of deaths due to drug overdose. And I think many are also aware that there's a critical organ shortage in this country. More than 115,000 Americans are on a wait list for a life-saving organ transplant. And as you mentioned, we've seen a dramatic rise in the number of donors who die from an overdose. So the objective of our study was to see how patients who received transplants from overdose death donors did in the long run.
So this is a tough thing to talk about. I think a lot of the ways that we could talk about this might sound a little bit ghoulish, but we got to talk about them because it's just the facts of the situation. And I suppose, Dr. Duran, the first question that I have for you is, putting aside the unspeakable tragedy of the deaths of people who are ODing on opioids, are they not sort of the ideal organ donors because they're not dying of trauma? They're often dying young, and they're dying in a physically, a chemically relatively gentle way that would leave the organs pretty well intact. Am I guessing that right?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, we are talking about the loss of one life leading to another life, saving another life. And that's a fact of organ donation. All of us will die someday. I hope that many of us will die in a way where we can give a gift of life to another person. We were interested in the outcomes of these transplants, and we hypothesized that many of these transplants would have excellent outcomes since the overdose death donors are typically younger donors who don't have chronic medical issues like high blood pressure or diabetes, which might affect their organs. And we did, in fact, find that patients who received transplants from donors who died from an overdose had excellent outcomes. They were the same or, in many cases, even better than organ transplants from donors who died from trauma or donors who died from medical causes.
Were there any surprises in your research?
One thing that did surprise us was that despite these excellent outcomes, we found that many of the organs donated were actually discarded. That is, they were surgically recovered, but then never used for transplant in any individuals in need.
Why would that happen?
We believe the most likely factors are two. One is that there is a growing prevalence of hepatitis C infection among those who die from an overdose. This is a risk to participants, but we now have curative therapy for hepatitis C. So this may be a risk that one who needs a transplant to save their lives could face. And the other issue that is likely leading to discard is that overdose death donors are labeled increased infectious risk, and that's because they have behaviors such as injecting drugs, which might put them at higher risk for infections like hepatitis or HIV. However, in today's organ donation world, we have excellent tests that can detect these infections at very early stages. So the true risk of getting an infection from a so-called increased infectious risk donor is actually quite low. And the biggest risk for someone on the wait list is dying because they need a transplant.
Yeah. We're talking about new research indicating that 1 in 8 organ transplants in the U.S. is now coming from a person who died of a drug overdose. That is a huge increase from just a couple of decades ago. Dr. Tom Pearson with the Emory Transplant Center, is this a study that you picked up and you read and you're like, yep, that confirms what I'm seeing day in, day out?
I think that's very much the case. I think we in Georgia, unfortunately, are not different than the rest of the country.
And everything that we're hearing about from Dr. Durand about the particular dynamics of, oh God, I hate to use the term, but I suppose it's the term you use, harvesting organs from patients who've died of drug overdoses. This is something you see in your own work?
That's true. I think Dr. Durand really identified the issues very well. I think all of us in transplantation would obviously wish the opioid epidemic and problem would go away. But it's here, and at least with the opportunity to save a life through organ donation and perhaps provide some sense of meaning to the donor family, there is some good that can come out of a terrible situation.
Sure. How do you have that conversation with a family? I mean, you know, you're talking about a donor class that, as Dr. Duran said, is generally young, and these are people who might not have thought about their mortality yet, might not have expressed a desire to be an organ donor. So I imagine that there have to be a lot of conversations with next of kin around these things. How do you do that?
Right. So that conversation is carried out by professionals in the organ procurement organization, which in our case in Georgia is LifeLink of Georgia. These are people that are very skilled and very trained in those conversations. And again, I think it's the good of it is the opportunity to provide some good or some feeling that to this family that's had this tragedy, that some positive has come out of it.
Okay. Dr. Durand, how did doctors in situations like this determine that organs are safe to be used for transplant?
So with any organ donor evaluation, there's an extensive set of evaluations, both to look at organ function and to look at any infectious risks. So we have decades of experience of this and really have very good parameters to assess the organ function. What we saw in our study, again, was that the five-year survival rates and the five-year organ function from for transplant recipients who had accepted an organ donated after an overdose were excellent. Again, the same, if not better, than organs from other types of donors. So we hope that the results of our study help providers, help patients who are trying to make a decision about whether or not to accept an organ donated after overdose. And just to follow up on what you were saying before, when I think about these donors and their families, they're really making a generous and compassionate decision in the midst of unspeakable tragedy. And these are people I admire. These are people whose decisions we want to honor. And it's really a selfless and compassionate thing that they're doing.
So even though there is this aspect of the opioid crisis, it nonetheless is, you know, I'm sure every medical professional would say the better thing to do is to get people to stop dying of opioids. Assuming that can be achieved through public health measures of various kinds, then we know that there will be a corresponding shortage of organs available for transplant. So what can people be doing in advance of that problem? I understand at Emory, Dr. Pearson, one of your specialties is working with live donors, people who are still alive and donating one of their kidneys, for example.
Right. So that is an option, probably most commonly available to people in need of a kidney transplant. By far and away, the most common live donor transplant is in the realm of kidney transplantation. There are innovative programs ongoing across the country to try and increase the opportunity for living kidney donation. One of those programs are paired donor exchange programs where one's emotionally or genetically related potential donor that doesn't match that actual recipient would donate to somebody else, and that person's donor would donate back to the original recipient. These type programs increase the opportunity for live donor kidney transplantation.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Durand at Johns Hopkins, what's the number one thing people can do to be making sure that there is a sufficient supply of organs available for transplant?
Well, I think for listeners today who are thinking, you know, I'm not young, I'm not healthy enough to be an organ donor, I think we're doing everything we can in the donation community to see every gift of life honored. So I would say anyone can be an organ donor. Talk to your family, talk to your loved ones about that decision, register to be an organ donor. We don't believe that the opioid overdose epidemic is a solution to the organ shortage, but we don't want to add tragedy on top of tragedy. So for those who die of an overdose and make the decision to save a life, we want to honor that.
That is Dr. Christine Durand. She's assistant professor of medicine and oncology at Johns Hopkins University, one of the co-authors of a study that finds that now one in eight organ transplants in the U.S. is coming from a patient who died of a drug overdose. That is up from 1 in 100 a couple of decades ago. Really, really striking finding. Thank you, Dr. Durand. And also with us there was Dr. Tom Pearson, executive director of the Emory Transplant Center. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
And listeners, we want to hear from you on this one. Is organ donation something that you have thought about? Is it something that you've talked about with your family? If so, how did you broach that topic? I think other people could learn from your example. If you've not been able to have that conversation, then tell us why not. If you've benefited from organ donation, we would love to hear about your experience as well. Give us a call at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. You can also post to our Facebook page. Just go to Facebook and search for On Second Thought or On Second Thought Radio. That's where we are on Facebook. Get in touch with us, and we might feature your comments on the show. What's your favorite ghost story from the South? Here at On Second Thought, we're partial to the ones from right here in Georgia, of course. In Rome, an 1886 flood devastated the town and forced it to elevate everything that it rebuilt. What remains beneath Rome is allegedly haunted. GPB's Emily Curitan toured the remains and brought back this audio postcard.
I'm Catherine Jackson. You'll go to five different locations, first levels and basements throughout Broad Street, just to see the different history and the different levels. So,
all right, everybody come this way, please. So I'm Rob, and I volunteer for the Sexual Assault Center on things like this and fundraising, and I'm a born and raised in Rome, Georgia, and that's about me. Keep coming. Don't be afraid. You might be afraid when we're done, but not right now. Keep coming. Come on. Come on. Everybody come on down. Come on. Come on. You will see that right back there is a walled-up window. Now, think about the fact that we are underground. They're not going to put a window to look at the dirt that is underneath the street. And I'm standing in the elevator. So if I'm bringing stuff in through the back, probably off of wagons, bringing it to an elevator, what am I carrying? Anybody guess? No guesses. Cotton, maybe, probably not. If it is, it's not much. What's that?
Supplies.
Maybe food, maybe clothing, maybe other things, maybe a little bit of cotton, right? So we know that William Whitley owned this building. William Whitley was a merchant. He registered himself in the city as a merchant. We also know that William Whitley registered himself as the undertaker for Rome, Georgia. So picture that maybe this next floor might have been the grocery store, the general store with corn and beef, and the next one might be the undertaker, so you have the bodies on the one side and you have the corn and the beef on the other side. If you have questions, please feel free to ask. Seriously, come over and look at it. I wouldn't stand on the elevator itself, not because it won't hold you, but because there's a crack. So there are some places in Rome, Georgia that are haunted. I believe it. You were probably up at the theater. You probably heard about Ruby and or the others.
Did she tell you about Ruby?
I bet it's the same story.
I'm Hannah Cook.
Well, the story, there used to be a trolley car on Broad. Of course, that's gone too once they raised the road and everything. But the story is that this little girl came and she was getting off the trolley and she fell and she got hit. And she got up and she went in and she watched all day because they would have back-to-back features. And when the day was over, she was gone. And she was dead. I'd end the theater, like, doing something she loved, watching these movies.
Do I believe in ghosts? I don't know. I'm not going to say no because I've never seen one. But I'm not going to say yes because I've never seen one. Rebecca Sharp. We live in Collinsville, Alabama, just about 45 minutes away.
New group. All right. Hey, guys. How's it going? Pay attention to this. Don't trip over it.
I'm Chris Jackson.
This will be the trap door I'm talking about, okay? I'm going to go ahead and walk down, but...
I've kind of helped put together the tour along with Mark Cochran, who's a local architect, and then a bunch of volunteers.
This is it's a water-powered engine that actually powered the elevator that brought cotton up and down.
My favorite thing about this is that we're upstairs in a bike shop, which is currently, you know, functioning as a business. There was a guy up there buying a bike while we were coming through, and then you walk down a flight of stairs and literally you're in the 1800s.
That was used in order to be able to sell cotton, because what block is this?
Cotton.
Right, absolutely, and they call it that because cotton was king in the late 1800s.
That postcard was produced by GPB's Emily Curitan. You've probably heard, or perhaps you've experienced, that after many years of marriage, couples tend to physically resemble each other after a while. Also, believe it or not, their personalities change in response to marriage as well. University of Georgia researchers studied couples' personalities after really just 18 months of marriage, early into the process. And On Second Thought producer Summer Evans just passed her one-year married bliss milestone. Happy anniversary, Summer. Summer talked to the study's lead psychologist about how her marriage is shaping up.
Today, I'm talking to Dr. Justin Lavner, Assistant Professor of Psychology at the University of Georgia. How are you doing today, Justin?
Doing well, Summer. How are you?
Great, great. So can you tell me about the purpose of this study?
So this study was interested in the question of whether people's personalities change after they get married. And so we know that marriage is one of the biggest transitions that people undergo. But no one had ever looked at whether or not kind of people's reports of their personality shift during this time. So what we did was we got a sample of 169 heterosexual newlywed couples who were recruited in Florida. And we got this big sample of couples together, and we assessed all of them within 6 months of their wedding. And then two more times at six-month intervals, so 6 months initially starting 6 months into marriage, then 12 months into marriage, then 18 months into marriage, we had them fill out questionnaires about their personalities, and were interested in whether or not we'd see shifts in how their personalities changed.
So what scale did you use in order to measure their personalities?
So we used a scale measuring the big five personality traits, which are common model that is seen to reflect different dimensions of personality. So those, you can think of the acronym OCEAN. So that stands for openness to experience, and that's the degree to which someone engages in the world behaviorally, emotionally, and cognitively in a curious and unconventional manner. So things like that kind of items would be things like I spend time reflecting on things and really assessing people's feelings, actions, and ideas. C is for conscientiousness. That's the tendency to take a careful and deliberative approach to life, and the degree to which someone has the resources necessary to delay gratification, pursue long-term goals, and kind of consider the consequences of behavior before acting. So that would be things like, I get chores done right away. Mm-hmm. E is for extroversion, so the extent to which someone's interested in, excited by, and prefers the company of others, taking on an active role in interpersonal settings and experiences positive emotions. So things like that would be whether or not you talk to a lot of different people at parties. And A is for agreeableness. So that's capturing one's interpersonal style, the degree to which you think of yourself and interact with others in a warm, empathic, trusting, and cooperative manner. So things like that would be whether you sympathize with other people's feelings. And then finally, neuroticism. Which is the tendency to experience strong and frequent negative emotions, such as anxiety, depression, and anger, and whether you're kind of vulnerable to life stresses. And so things like that would be whether or not you get upset easily. So again, the Big Five model, Big Five personality traits are openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism.
So as we've talked about before, I got married about a year ago. Sunday, we celebrated our year anniversary. And on the phone with us is my husband, Seth Evans. How are you doing, babe?
Good. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for having me on here.
So we wanted to talk about how our personalities have changed over the last year, and kind of self-reflect as well as look at each other's and see if we've seen anything that has been different. So Seth, have you noticed any personality changes over this last year? You know, I know we were together 4 years prior to getting married, but, you know, we've moved in together and everything, and a lot's changed. So have you noticed anything?
Yeah, I've definitely noticed a personality change in myself. I've noticed that I'm much more attentive, I guess, to details in terms of, you know, where things go around the house. I mean, I guess just being a man, I'm a little messy, so... when I come home, I'm definitely more attentive to, you know, specific household items have specific places, and I'm attentive to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've definitely noticed when, you know, there's usually a cup sitting in the sink or like in the bathroom, he'll definitely put it away without me touching it, or he'll be like, hey, I'm going to get to that, you know, in a minute, just let me do my thing. And so, you know, I've tried to back off in that way.
Have you noticed any personality changes in yourself?
Yeah, I, you know, living on my own most of the time, I never notice how I can be a little bit neurotic when it comes to picking up certain things. Like, I've always had, like, everything goes in a certain place. I'm very orderly. I hate clutter. And I kind of noticed my tendency to be a little bit naggy of, like, okay, why haven't you picked that up yet, you know, and, you know, put the shoes in the closet and everything. And so I've kind of noticed myself be a little bit anal when it comes to certain placing things and where they need to go.
Yeah, I think I've noticed that as well, which, you know, maybe that is why I'm a little bit more attentive to details. But, I mean, it's a very, you know, structured mindset, I guess, that you have. And it really helps me, you know, keeps me straight. So,
yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and what's interesting is the patterns that you described are some of the patterns that we saw in our sample of couples as well. And so we saw both adaptive and maladaptive changes in couples' personality. So the two that you just described were some of the more adaptive changes we saw. So what we saw was that husbands, on average, reported increases in their level of conscientiousness. And again, that reflects some of the things that Seth was talking about being more attentive to household items and things like that. And part of the reason that we were expecting that to happen is because wives, on average, are more conscientious than their husbands. And so what we are guessing is happening is that wives are kind of encouraging their husbands to be a little bit more conscientious around the house, and then they're encouraging them to do that, reinforcing them when they do that, resulting in increases in their husband's conscientiousness. And that sounds like what you were describing. On the flip side, we also saw that wives, on average, declined in their neuroticism over the first year and a half of marriage. And some of that there reflects, Summer, what you were talking about being somewhat stressed and anxious about how things are. And they're really seeing, on average, declines in that among the wives in our sample. So really reflected in the patterns that the two of you just described.
Mm-hmm. So there's some hope for me to be a little bit less neurotic in the next 6 months of our marriage.
Yes, definitely.
So how did you calculate these results from the answers you got from the couples?
Yeah, so one of the things that couples did was they filled out this measure of their personality traits every 6 months. And then what that allowed us to do was it allowed us to see how a couple's own individual's own score changed over time. And that was what was really valuable about this study, was we weren't comparing one group of people who had just gotten married and another group of people who had gotten married a couple of years prior and comparing them, because they're different people. It can be hard to draw conclusions from that. So here, what was really important about our study was we studied the exact same people over time, and then we're able to examine how their own scores changed. Mm-hmm. So if you and Seth were in the study, you would have filled out these measures three different times, and then we would have calculated and then examined how your scores changed. And then we took averages based on the entire sample of 169 couples.
So what would you say is the next phase for this?
So I think for us, we're really interested in understanding these changes over longer periods of time. We'd be interested in understanding them among same-sex couples as well, as I mentioned. And then also trying to understand how these changes in personality also link up with changes in marital satisfaction. And so one of the things that people will kind of talk about when they talk about their marriage is, oh, I changed, or oh, he changed, or she changed, and that's why I'm more or less satisfied, and trying to understand the extent to which we see those sorts of associations and for what sorts of people they're true for.
That was On Second Thought producer Summer Evans talking with University of Georgia professor Justin Lavner. We also heard from Summer's husband, Seth. Congratulations on a year well done, I assume. And now let's hear a little bit of Summer and Seth's wedding song, We Found Each Other in the Dark. It's by the band City and Color.
I heard the church bells from afar. But smoke does finally pass.
Now, another story of love and marriage, love and music. Opera singers Cheryl Milnes and Maria Zuvis are married and have also worked together to enlarge Savannah's opera scene. We have asked them to contribute two songs to our Central Georgia playlist. The rules for this are simple. Nominations have to be songs written or performed by a Georgian, and it cannot be one of their own. We add their picks to our ever-growing Essential Georgia playlist.
My name is Cheryl Milnes, an opera singer, retired now, sang all over the world, especially at the Metropolitan Opera, 32 years, more than 650 performances, which doesn't make me sweat now, but did then.
Moon River, wider than a mile.
Well, I guess the song that I would choose, because I don't know a ton of them, but obviously the biggest name is Johnny Mercer, and I suppose Moon River, because there is a Moon River here in the Savannah area. It's a great piece, and there's a couple of others Mercer songs, but that's perhaps the most famous.
Wherever you're going, I'm going your way.
How does that song go? You're not paying me to sing. I don't do that anymore. Moon River. Actually, he didn't write the tune. He wrote the words. But the words are beautiful. And when you cross on one of the highways, you cross Moon River, it has special meaning. Music, you know, music appeals to the emotions of the human creature. And that's what music is about, emotion. And it touches me.
Waiting round the bend, my huckleberry friend. Moon River and me.
Yeah, it was the main song in the movie Breakfast at Tiffany's, and starring, among others, Audrey Hepburn. And, of course, who didn't love Audrey Hepburn? Actually, I met her at a couple of Metropolitan Opera affairs later in her life, but, you know, who didn't love Audrey Hepburn?
Moon River and me.
My name is Maria Zuvis, and I am a Greek-American soprano who now produces opera with the Cheryl Milnes Voice Programs.
Sue wants a barbecue, Sam wants to boil a ham, Grace votes for bouillabaisse stew.
Well, being part of Savannah, I would choose a Johnny Mercer song. I would choose In the Cool of the Evening.
We'll rent a tent.
I love the part, when the party's getting the glow on and singing fills the air. I love that part. It's so much fun. You have to snap. You can't sing without snapping.
When the party's getting the glow on, singing fills the air.
For us as opera people, it's a good thing to steer off the path of all that classical stuff and just have a good time. I think that Georgia is so diverse. There's so much going on in the state of Georgia in terms of music. It's not just about the region. It's about the people, and it's about their love of getting together and sharing music, because music is about coming together. So for me, Georgia is all kinds of music.
That's Cheryl Milnes and Maria Zuvis with their picks for our Georgia playlist. and a lot of love for Johnny Mercer. That's it for our show today, but as always, we want to hear from you, from our couples out there. Do you and your significant other have a special song? Tell us about it. Give us a call, 404-500-9457, or you can post on Twitter or Facebook. On the Twitters, we're at OST Talk. The show is produced by Maura Curry, Fenley Fox and LaRaven Taylor, Leighton Rowell, and Summer Evans. Sean Powers is the senior producer. Don Smith edits the show, and Tanya Ott is the executive producer. The engineer is Tyler Morris. Special thanks to the interns, Emmanuel Johnson, Emily Bunker, and Reed Williams. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusa. Have a good one.